Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes, and this is another two-hour Zero Point Radio show through BBS Radio. It is September the 18th, and I'm coming to you from just south of Ottawa, Ontario, Canada, and my co-host, James Moffat. Jim, how are you?
I'm good. How are you, Chris?
Good. Jim is from Toronto, Ontario. And Jim's been a co-host on the show. We're into our fourth or fifth year at the moment. And Jim and I met in high school, and for the last 40 years have explored mystical teachings, modern science, religion, philosophy.
Parapsychology,
yeah. Yeah, widely in trying to understand the mysteries and science and so on. And so Jim really has a kind of lifelong involvement with the same kinds of teachings and ideas and work that I do, as well as he's been an editor on my all of my varied books, which I've printed. And I'm very pleased to say, I think this week, my newest work called God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine, subtitled The Zero-Point Metaphysics and Holographic Space of H.P. Blavatsky. I hope within the next 2 to 3 days this book will be available through Amazon. At the moment, I had a proof copy of the book in trade paperback format, 6 by 9 inch trade paperback format. And I had some formatting and other slight errors to fix up and a few of the graphics, and I'm supposed to receive a new proof copy within the next 2 days. And as soon as I receive that, I can approve it, and then it'll be available through Amazon. And this book is $24.95, and it's a very, very interesting book. And Jim and I will be talking about that today. And especially, it's interesting that this book is finally being made available at the exact time that we have a new book that's just come out by Stephen Hawking called The Grand Design. And what we're going to do in today's show, we're going to both be talking about the physics and metaphysics of the secret doctrine, which is what my book is about. But we're also going to talk about Hawking's newest book, and I'm going to provide a critical analysis of that based on my Blavatsky studies. See, I would say the perfect counterpart to Stephen Hawking's new book, The Grand Design, is my book, God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine, and it presents exactly the opposite type of perspective. So today I want to go into and review Stephen Hawking's book, and Jim, by chance, you haven't had a chance to pick this up, have you?
No, I haven't. It just arrived in the bookstore. I just saw it, and, reacted just to the announcement that came out from sort of his declaration about gravity and God, but I haven't actually, substantively, I don't even know what the book's about.
Yeah, oh, well, good. It'll be very interesting today because I'll fill you in on it as much as I can and try to explain. Like I myself am trying to get to the essentials of it. It's not a long book.
That's what struck me, is it doesn't seem like it's that long.
No, it's about, I think it's 170 pages, every chapter has like 4 pages of blank pages or pictures, so it's about 150, 160 pages.
Okay.
It's kind of large print and a lot of pictures. I mean, I'm sure, you know, in terms of full-size pages, it's about a 100-page book. It's really quite short. I read it in like a day and a half there, you know. Yeah, I felt I had to read it because we were talking about it. And it's amazing reading it, Jim, because what it absolutely does for me is it brings up again what you and I for 30 years have referred to as the problem of God's contracting universe.
Oh, and I have to read it now for sure. Okay.
You will need to read it. And it's so interesting. It's so frustrating in ways because,
yes.
You know, I want him to kind of explain these newest ideas he's saying are kind of providing these ultimate answers, eh? And it's so empty. Like, the book is mainly, I'd say three-quarters of it deals with the history of science and all standard kinds of fare, like everything from wave-particle duality to the uncertainty principle and the particle-wave nature of light and material elements and, you know, the Big Bang and expanding universe, all these topics that I cover in my book as well. But he a lot of his material is all like the history of science and the history of wrong ideas, kind of. And then when it gets to the end, like he's proposing M theory,
right,
as like the ultimate solution. And he at one point says this is like the unified theory that Einstein was searching for, you know, even though the details have yet to be worked out. Yeah. But this is the best candidate. But then he uses his old argument to argue the idea that now that we have natural laws to explain the origin and creation of the universe, there's no need for a creator.
Right.
So it says, essentially he's saying as science advances, there's less and less for
God
to do.
Yeah,
now we've arrived. Stephen Hawking thinks that M theory is this ultimate theory, so now we don't need the creator anymore. So what I want to do is I want to kind of go back through this. I have kind of a lecture plotted out here, and
that'll be nice
to kind of go through his book with quotes and stuff like that. And I'm writing up a review, which I'm going to put up on my website.
Oh yeah, good idea.
Yeah, and in addition to reading his book, I also caught a special on CNN where they had
Larry King, was he on Larry King?
Yeah, Larry King Live. They had Stephen Hawking with like he was like somewhere else and supposedly kind of answering the questions through his kind of robotic voice,
right,
computer, whatever arrangement he uses. And it had Leonard Mlodin now on, who was the co-author of his book.
Oh, okay.
And then they had Deepak Chopra and this Jesuit priest who was very, very interesting and spoke very well. And Chopra spoke well, absolutely beautifully at one point. He quoted Rumi to the effect of that, like the spinning of God kind of created the universe, which was beautiful because it was so like Blavatsky's Fohat's run circular errands, and they kind of create through spin, you know. And yeah, beautiful quote. Chopra and the Jesuit priest were very good and articulate. It was a very interesting discussion. And then this fellow was on Coast to Coast with George Norrie. And I took in the first hour and a half of it, but fell asleep at about 2:30 at night, so I didn't hear the response to him. But Coast to Coast ran a poll afterwards on their website, Jim, and it was like, do you believe that like there's evidence for a creator or believe in not a creator? And their poll, it was 48% of people believed that there was some god or supernatural means that created the universe. Approximately 18% agreed with Hawking's basic thesis that, you know, now we have science, we kind of don't need God or supernatural means. And then the remaining, what was that?
38% left, I think, to go.
38%. We're undecided.
No, 48, 56, 34%.
Okay, so the last 34% were undecided, which,
right,
you know, yeah, they were undecided. So really, it was very interesting. Like, that was like one out of five people kind of accept that type of view, as we'll come to, and I'll be explaining it today.
But One thing I just wanted to mention that just briefly was that I read A Brief History of Time, Hawking's first book. I don't know if it was his first book, but his first book written for the public. And a couple of things. One, terrible book in the sense that terribly written book, I thought. I thought it was very convoluted and very difficult to understand. And not just because the material is you know, he's not dealing with easy ideas. I'll grant that. But, I mean, I've read many good science writers have presented these ideas in a much more elegant and succinct fashion, I think. And but what really struck me about, and strikes me about all the interviews I've read with him, too, is that I don't understand the jumps he makes from what he observes as a physicist about the physical nature of the world to the metaphysical, spiritual conclusions that he arrives at. See, it's like Dawkins too. It's that these really aren't the things he's looking at in terms of the physical universe have to do with physics, and by definition, they don't involve spiritual or even animistic conceptions of the universe. They don't have anything to do with spirit. They don't have anything to do with the soul. They don't have anything to do with God. So what I don't understand about his arguments is this jump he makes. I regard it as being unscientific. I not only reject what he says just in terms of my own knowledge and my understanding of esotericism and mysticism, I don't even think it makes sense scientifically. I don't get where he's coming from. I think it's an expression of a prejudice and really is based on his own assumptive framework, but isn't really rooted in what he's talking about. And it boggles my mind. It's kind of frustrating, as you said, reading someone who's this intelligent that they don't seem to understand this, that they're really on shaky ground here. Well, they're not even on shaky ground. They're just like it just doesn't withstand scrutiny.
Yeah, that brings to mind a quote, a very brief one at the moment, from Margaret
Wertheim.
Yeah, Wertheim's book, Pythagoras' Trousers: God, Physics, and the Gender Wars, which is a very excellent book, and I may quote
part
of it later. But she does a critique of Hawking's and other physicists.
Right.
I'll read a little bit about this. She says, Stephen Hawking, Leon Lederman, and George Smoot, these are men at the heart of contemporary physics. All these men have publicly associated the quest for a unified theory with God. In drawing an association with contemporary physics and God, they are not alone. Indeed, this kind of dialogue has become endemic among physicists, at least as far as their popular writings is concerned. But many physicists using the God draw card are not engaged in serious theological or spiritual thinking. Following a millennia-old tradition that has associated mathematically based science with divinity, they simply assume it is legitimate to present their activities in a quasi-religious light. Despite the supposedly secular climate of 20th century science, some physicists are once again demanding that we see them as our high priests, leading humanity upward towards transcendent, even divine knowledge of the world. Which is a very interesting critique. Like she's saying, well, they're kind of portraying themselves as kind of the new priests for the secular age, is these kind of, you know, giants of intellect, you know, and that they're going to show us the truth and lead us on, you know, like Sagan, you know, science is a candle in the dark to help us overcome all these kind of superstitious and metaphysical and religious ideas, you know.
The dogma of these things, yeah. It's in Bernard Haitch's book, The God Theory, he talks, he has a similar passage where he says that Hawking's God sounds a lot very similar to a guy like Hawking, and you know, a member of the Royal Society, very smart, maybe a little smarter, who'd sort of fix creation up and improve on what God had done. You know, it's very funny what he says about him, and that's I think there's a certain it's funny. Like, I think most people would be kind of flabbergasted, but there's a certain narcissism and total lack of self-awareness in these scientists' pronouncements about God. They don't seem to be aware of their own limitations, and there's a certain lack of humility that I find really quite appalling in their pronouncements. I mean, they're certainly entitled to their opinions. And you know, their ideas about whether or not God exists, the soul or spirit or whatever, that's not the objection. The objection is that what they're doing is that really it's a different kind of dogmatism. It's like rather than invoking scripture as their authority, they're invoking science as their authority to make pronouncements about spiritual matters. And as I say, that's just not scientifically, that's just not realistic. I mean, that violates the first rule of science. You can't make pronouncements which aren't supported by evidence and aren't supported by an investigation of whatever that you're investigating. You have to specify what exactly you're investigating, then you have to draw conclusions based on that examination, and they don't do that. They jump way over their boundaries.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's why Wertheim's book is so interesting, because she really takes them to task as a physicist herself. She takes them to task and says, you know, these guys are appropriating the role of the priesthood now because they're so knowledgeable about the physical constituents of the universe and the processes that account for it.
So what struck me, I'm still trying to assimilate the book, The Grand Design, because I read it through once and then have to start working at it more to try to, you know, get the overall argument, the pattern of the argument. But I think I have that, and we'll kind of, through today's show, we'll unravel that in stages. But I did want to take the listener back, because you and I, for 30 years, have explored this concept of the problem of God's contracting universe. And Jim is actually writing a book about my life and ideas with that as a title. But anyway, 30 years ago, I read Carl Sagan's book, Broca's Brain, Reflections on the Romance of Science. And in it, he had a chapter called A Sunday Sermon, where he talked about the advancement of science and how he this is what I quote from that chapter. It used to be believed that every event in the world, the opening of a morning glory, let us say, was due to direct micro-intervention by the deity. The flower was unable to open by itself. God had to say, "Hey, flower, open." There are many legitimate scientific issues related to origins and ends. What is the origin of the human species? Where did plants and animals come from? How did life arise? The earth, the planets, the sun, the stars? Does the universe have an origin? And if so, what? And finally, a still more fundamental and exotic question, which many scientists would say is essentially untestable and therefore meaningless: why are the laws of nature the way they are? The idea that a god or gods is necessary to effect one or more of these origins has been under repeated attack for over the last few thousand years. Because we know something about phototropism and plant hormones, we can understand the opening of the morning glory independently of divine micro-intervention. It is the same for the entire skin of causality back to the origin of the universe. As we learn more and more about the universe, there seems less and less for God to do. And 30 years ago, I focused on that and raised this problem of God's contracting universe, asking, well, is this true? What is it that science has learnt that's invalidated what the mystics or mystery teachings explain. Like, how does it contradict ancient metaphysical or religious ideas? And that's, for the last 30 years, I've been trying to understand that question. And there's, because what I've realized is, in many ways, see, what I would argue today is that as science has advanced, what it has actually done is confirmed a series of ancient mystical ideas about creation physics, that it's actually validated these concepts. And some of the concepts, I focus on The Secret Doctrine of H.P. Blavatsky, which is a classic book of Western occultism, described by Manly Hall, a Masonic 33rd degree Mason, as undoubtedly the magnus opus of the literature of the modern world. So this was a book written in 1888. And what I, if I look at what Blavatsky wrote in 1888, what I see in modern science is that modern physics has confirmed one after another of her predictions. And what I want to do today is go into some of all these things which she stated, which now have been confirmed in the newest science. Now, Hawking knows the newest science, but he has no idea that any of that has any relationship to what was said in The Secret Doctrine or other mystical sources. So, although, like, these people like Hawking, Jim, they seem, they're knowledgeable in their area of science, but they kind of step outside of it, and then they give their own personal philosophies, but they're not really studied in the topics that they're addressing. Like, they're not really studied in what esoteric accounts of creation involve. Instead, in their books, like in Hawking's book, when it comes about, they talk about creation myths of different people. Like, they're silly little myths, you know, where a cow jumps over a moon and, like, ridiculous stories, which I've never heard of. But they don't look at any serious occult metaphysics. And that's why, like, Wertheim says of Stephen Hawking, she says, Hawking is not a serious theological thinker. And you can see that he isn't. Instead, he's a scientist who's very, very gifted in his area. But then he kind of, you know, he takes a leap of faith himself. But what he does is he presents his findings as though they derive from science, whereas really they're not based on science. They're just based more on his personal perspective and interpretation of the facts of science. And he doesn't seem to see that. That's what I object to in this book. It's like science proves there's no need for God. But that's not true. There was science in the book, but it was the interpretation of the science he gives leads him to say God doesn't, we don't need a creator, but that wasn't inherent within any of the scientific ideas he presents.
Yeah, it's precisely the same thing that that Richard Dawkins says in The God Delusion. He says that Darwin's theory of evolution, the theory of natural selection, made it possible for him to be a fulfilled atheist. Well, Darwin's theory of evolution doesn't do away with spiritual or spiritual realities or God or the existence of the soul. What it does was it counters fundamentalist Christian scripture, Christian interpretations of scripture. And when people are making absurd claims that the universe is 4,004 years old, or was started in 4,004 BC, whatever it is, 6,000 years old, but it doesn't do away with the entire, all religious and spiritual teachings, and that's where what all of these people like Dawkins, Hawking, Sagan, Dennett, Sam Harris, Christopher Hitchens, all of these people who have written books about God and about the death of God, they all share the same shortcoming in the sense that they all have this incredibly simplistic understanding of religious and spiritual realities and religious and spiritual teachings. And basically what they attack is always fundamentalist Christian teachings. They very rarely talk about the Vedas or the Upanishads. They never talk about Kabbalah. They never talk about anything esoteric or mystical, because they by caveat, they dismiss that. Like Hawking says in his conversation with Renee Weber in her book, Dialogues with Scientists and Sages, I very much disapprove of mysticism. But he evinces no knowledge of mysticism. I'd love to know what he understands by mysticism. I think he has absolutely no clue as to what it means.
Yeah, well, I agree. I don't think they have any understanding that there is a complex kind of metaphysical occult literature there that actually could be evaluated, in my view, from a scientific perspective. Like you, as you see in my book on the secret doctrine, I explain Blavatsky in 1888, she said, like what you have to do is lay side by side the ancient wisdom and modern science and draw comparisons, and that's what I do in my book on the secret doctrine, and you see all kinds of amazing comparisons. But in Hawking's book, when he talks about religion or mysticism, it's just in a pejorative, fanciful way. He never looks seriously as to what such teachings entail. But so anyway, so this problem of God's contracting universe was posed for Jim and I 30 years ago, and this has been a long kind of thread in our explorations, trying to understand these issues of religion and science. And
well,
it's interesting.
I just wanted to interject quickly, Chris, and say one thing, which is that I guess you've written 7 books, or depending on how you count them, 7 or 8 books, and you were the one that came up with that as the title for one of your books, The Problem of God's Contracting Universe, but then you dropped it later, and I've taken that as the title of the book in which I examine your work. But I think it really describes a whole corpus of all of your writing. I think that would be the label for it all. And it shows the complexity of the question, because you've been trying to answer the question for 30 years, and you're still not finished.
No, I'm still trying to draw parallels and comparative study between mystical occult teachings and modern science. It ties into other areas, too, because the issue of the existence of God, it doesn't only tie into the issue of creation of the universe. It also ties into the question of the existence or non-existence of a human spirit or soul. That is, there's something within the human being, that we're not simply biological organisms, but that there's some divine or spiritual nature within us. So the idea of God in science, and also in psychology, it ties most intimately into the issue, what is the nature and origin of human consciousness? And what I've tried to do in the study of consciousness, and show that mystical spiritual teachings actually offer a whole alternative scientific view of consciousness originating out of the heart and related to the blood flow in the body, and that its consciousness is related to the light of the spiritual self within the heart. And there's a whole framework of ideas in mystical teachings which provide a theory about the origins and nature of human consciousness, very, very different from the theory of modern times, which is a belief in modern science that the material brain produces consciousness, which is centered in the head. And I call that the head doctrine. So part of my lifelong exploration of this issue of the problem of God's contracting universe has been to the investigations of the nature of human consciousness. And then the second area of my life interest has been in creation physics. That's what I write about fairly extensively in my work, is explaining ancient metaphysical ideas about creation and trying to relate those to concepts in modern physics.
Wanted to point out one other thing too, that which ties those two things together, which I think might be easy to misconstrue. As very interesting in Bernard Hayes's book, The God Theory, he says, you know, that he talks about in his theory that God is this intelligence which informs and sustains creation. So it's not like the idea, and I think like when Madame Blavatsky says that there's an omniscient intelligence which thrills through every finite point of within the universe. It's not like that, you know, in Newton's time, like that Newton believed that God had created the world and established the laws of nature, and the deist perspective after Newton was that God had set everything in motion, but then basically God was no longer involved. So in the 17th and the first half of the 18th century, God was still there, but then eventually, well, why do we even need God as the prime mover, as the architect of all this? And God just got dropped entirely in the 19th century. And this perspective isn't saying that God just created the universe, but God continues, this absolute intelligence continues to be operative, like underlying everything in the material planes of creation are these higher levels of subtle intelligence and consciousness which are exist in a hierarchy of world orders which sustain everything. So it's like it's a dynamic model. It's not a static model where, you know, there was a Big Bang and God created the Big Bang and then stepped back and watched it all. It's very different kind of perspective.
Yeah. Yeah, and Blavatsky is similar to who you were mentioning. Like, Blavatsky doesn't see God as doing all these creation of all these separate beings, but rather she sees there being a hierarchy of intelligences which embody that ultimate divine spirit. So there's a realm of the Elohim, or the seven creative spirits, and then there are the Thohats, which are who run their errands and impress divine mind upon material matter. So in Blavatsky, there's a hierarchy of what she calls masons, who construct the universe. So the initial impetus is given by God, but then the working out of the laws of nature and creation and such, it is carried out through a hierarchy of intelligences that embody that divine will. So there's a hierarchy of masons so it's not just Mr. God, like Stephen Hawking and Carl Sagan and others. Like, they usually portray God as like a patriarch who sits up in heaven. Like Carl Sagan talks, you know, God has to talk to the flower and say to the flower, hey, flower, open. Like, it's a man who's kind of talking to flowers. Like, that's their kind of juvenile conception of God. Whereas if you get into the mystical literature, what we have is this absolute source, but then its will is made manifest through a hierarchy of intelligences that embody that divine intelligence into different material and subtle worlds.
Yeah.
So
it's like in Sagan at one point too, he says, I believe it's actually in Broca's Brain, where he says that it might be in, I think it's actually in a Sunday sermon, where he says something to the effect that I know of no compelling evidence for the existence of a bearded patriarch or oversees creation, but it would be madness to deny the existence of natural laws. So, like, you have this simplistic dichotomy, like the God choices according to Sagan are bearded patriarch who sits up in heaven and multitasks and, you know, overlooks creation and tells sparrows to what to do and flowers to open and tells the angels to push the planets and keep them in line. He has all these bizarre examples. Or the existence of natural laws. But like that, it's an either or. But I mean, it's a simplistic conceptualization. And it's a phony question. I mean, sure, there are natural laws. I mean, that's what we extrapolate. That's what human beings have extrapolated to describe regularities in the physical universe. But there's nothing in the existence of natural laws which denies spiritual intelligences. And in fact, that's more and more what physics, I think, is moving towards with the recognition of the importance of information. I think eventually that people will realize that you know, that's not just intelligence or information, that there's an intelligence behind all this, and that it is a spiritual intelligence. And that would be entirely consistent with what mystical teachings say.
So I thought I'd like to, before I talk about the grand design, I thought it prompted me to go back and read my chapter on Hawking in my book, God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine. I have a very brief chapter on him called Stephen Hawking and the Badly Behaved Points. And what this has to do with is this idea of the creation of the universe from a singularity condition. Now, just to give some background to this, scientists back in the early 1900s realized we live in an expanding universe. So they extrapolated back in time, and by about 1960s, they had the concept of this Big Bang, that at the beginning of time, there was this massive sun-like body which blew up and created a Big Bang, and this created the matters and energy that came to form the universe. Well, from the 1960s up to the year 2000 and up to the present day, scientists have extended back their understanding of the initial creation events. Now, in 1965, Steven Weinberg wrote the book called The First 3 Minutes, and he is able to describe the physics of the first 3 minutes of the universe. Well, now scientists trace the universe back to its original point source emergence at a diameter of 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. This is, they believe, our huge universe emerged from a point source, and that it grew within without, and that initially it underwent a rapid inflationary era, and that the universe has been expanding ever since. So they believe our universe emerged from a point source, and this is the distance of 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. That has to do with the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, because in quantum theory, you can only measure the position or momentum of a particle to a certain level of discreteness, after which you can't measure further. You can't measure further. So what happens is you try to measure a particle to a point, but you reach a certain level which you can't go further, because the measurement itself becomes undefined beyond the level of 10 to minus 33 centimeters. Okay, but besides that, now the concept is the universe emerged from this infinitely small point. Now, if you go back to 1888 and Blavatsky's presentation of the secret doctrine, Blavatsky begins at one point. She says, "Before me is an archaic manuscript, and on the first page there is a circle, and there's nothing in the circle, and that represents space. And on the second page there's a circle, but with a point in the center." And Blavatsky said that point within the circle represents the first point of differentiation of a cosmos. And in the secret doctrine, Blavatsky explains that cosmoses originate from what she calls Leia centers, or a zero-point condition. So Blavatsky, back in 1888, was predicting our universe emerged from a zero-point condition, what she called a zero-point, or a ring past naught, something that was so small that it passed beyond perception. So Blavatsky was stating this in 1888, and it was a century before physicists arrived at this concept. Now, the concept itself of a universe emerging from a point, that's not only in Blavatsky. And the Blavatsky secret doctrine is supposed to represent the perennial wisdom teaching. So it's similar to other teachings in other traditions. In Kabbalistic teachings, there is the establishment of the first point in the crown Sephira on the Tree of Life in Keter, and that's described as the first point, infinitesimal point. So the concept of the emergence of the universe from a point source is an ancient mystical conception. So the fact that the modern scientists trace our universe back to a singularity, that doesn't prove that, oh, science now answers the question and we don't need mysticism, because the scientists' answer to where the universe came from is actually confirming what Blavatsky said in 1888 and ancient Kabbalists said and ancient Vedic scholars said. They had bindi points. That universes grow in a way within without from zero points. So this is an ancient mystical concept. And Blavatsky in The Secret Doctrine, she draws from the stanzas of Zan, which are supposed to be these archaic stanzas, which she claims were dictated by divine beings to the first humans in the fifth round, which we're said to be on the fifth round or fifth cycle of life on planet Earth. At the beginning of the fifth round, these divine beings brought forward this knowledge from earlier period. Anyway, in the stanzas of Zan, they begin by describing a condition that exists before creation happens, when everything is absorbed in non-being. So time was not, the seven ways to bliss were not, the sources of life were not, the seven suns were absorbed within the web of light. Not was. So the first stanzas describe before creation occurred, everything was absorbed in non-being, the one being. Okay, this is like the transcendental principle. And then, so then the stanzas depict creation as occurring out of this absolute. And this absolute is described as, in paradoxical terms, it is described as absolute darkness, but which contains the infinite light. It is described as empty and seemingly void, but at the same time, the plenum. The plenum means something which contains the abundance of something. The plenum, or the pleroma, the divine pleroma. In Kabbalah, it's called the Ein Sof. And within the Ein Sof is said to exist before creation occurs. What exists in the Ein Sof is all possible creatures in all possible states of their growth, evolution, and perfection through all possible cycles of life. It's like all possibilities exist within the divine plenum. That's the root principle, which contains all possibilities for creation and manifestation. So what Blavatsky was described in 1888, in modern times, this came to be called vacuum genesis, because scientists now believe that before the singularity, all there was the quantum vacuum. And they described the quantum vacuum in paradoxical ways, just like Blavatsky did. They describe it as seemingly empty and void, but really within the quantum vacuum, there is this infinite vast sea of electromagnetic energies and radiations, and there's all this potentiality and energy latent within the non-being. So the quantum vacuum, which seems to be empty, is really the plenum, and that's what it's even called by physicists. One physicist said about the in the 21st century, he says, physicists will come to love the quantum vacuum, because it's like all of modern physics is trying to understand the nature of this seeming nothingness, which has this kind of hidden potentiality in it. Okay, so coming back then. So what modern science believes, they trace the universe back to a singularity which emerged out of the quantum vacuum. Okay. Now, the point is, modern scientific descriptions of this are perfectly in confirmation of what Blavatsky described in 1888. Okay, essentially creation ex nihilo, creation out of what is seemingly a nothingness. But for Blavatsky, she calls it the absolute. She calls it that, meaning like that, which she puts all in capitals. And if she means that, which is just unspeakable, like you just can't put a word on it. Okay. So these newest ideas of vacuum genesis and creation from singularities, and then the next thing in modern science is that the universe expands within without from this zero point. And that's also what Blavatsky describes. She describes the universe growing from a point source. And she says the suns and expand and contract through their own hearts and selves. So it's like cosmos is expand from the heart. It opens up and they, yeah. So Blavatsky described expanding space-times. And then Blavatsky described that over time, eventually, she says, the divine essence, the breath of the Father, passes over to the breath of the divine Mother, and the divine Mother ingathers the universe again to her bosom. And once again, she describes the universe, the life principle, as withdrawing to through zero-point centers. So the universe, see, it's like in the beginning. It's perfectly symmetrical. In the beginning, you have absolute blackness. And then you have a point source of light, first point of supernal lux. And then that expands within without in the creation of expanding universes. And eventually the universes contract without within back to the zero-point source and then back into the darkness again. And Blavatsky says that you have cycles of 7 nights of Brahma followed by 7 days of Brahma. So there's these cycles of creation, or what she calls manvantara, which means like cosmic manifestation. And then you have periods of what she calls pralaya, where things withdraw into their laya state, in their laya centers. So Blavatsky not only describes an expanding universe, but she describes it contracting back again at the end of time, back to singularity condition and disappearance into the quantum vacuum at the end of time. Now, modern scientists, they conceive the universe could collapse in this way, according to whether or not they can find enough dark matter in the universe to close it. Otherwise, they think the universe will continue to expand. And in recent years, scientists are discovering that not only is the universe expanding, but it's also increasing its rate of expansion. So in modern science, they think the universe, the main view is the universe will continue just to expand forever until it becomes more and more dissipated. Okay, whereas Blavatsky has this view that there's this higher dimensional divine force which will ingather the universe to the bosom of the divine mother at the end of time. Okay, so Blavatsky then also had a view of what's called oscillating universes. Physicists now think that the universe comes out into the quantum vacuum from a point, it expands within without. It could collapse what they call the big crunch at the end of time, where it collapses back into black holes and then they all form one supermassive black hole and then it all disappears in the ultimate singularity at the end of time. That's the alpha point or the omega point. Okay, the point of creation is the alpha point. The point of dissolution of the universe is the omega point. So scientists imagine our universe might emerge from an alpha point and dissipate at the end of time into an omega point. But what they don't conceive, which is the idea of in the secret doctrine, is that any cosmos has a zero point center that exists from the very beginning of creation to the very beginning of the end of time. That there's a zero point foundation all through. So the zero-point singularity, you don't only have it at the beginning and at the end, but you have it all the time in between, even though it's obscured by the veils of nature. Okay, this is a very important idea in the secret doctrine, how it differs from modern physics. I've heard of physicists thinking creation from singularities and dissolution into singularities, but no physicists think that any cosmos has a singularity that exists all the while, eternally, all through this whole process. So that's very important difference here. So anyway, so coming back, so what Blavatsky was describing in 1888, she described what we would currently call as a multiverse. See, Blavatsky's saying ours isn't the only creation. This has been going on for eons, for eternity. Infinite numbers of universes created and manifested over eons of time. All these different worlds created in this way. So she had an idea of what's in current science called the multiverse. So all these concepts were in Blavatsky's work in 1888. Now, so I've digressed off for a minute there, Jim, to give some background. But see, so then when I looked back on my notes on Stephen Hawking, it's interesting to see what he was arguing in A Brief History of Time, because back at that point, what he said, he objected to the idea of the universe emerging from a singularity point. Now, this concept of singularity is predicted by the general theory of relativity, describing space-time collapse, which can pass to infinity. Like, mathematically, there's no reason why space-time curvature cannot pass to infinity. But mathematically, in a way, it doesn't make sense. So Hawking hated the idea that the universe began from a singularity, because of the singularity, the idea is that the laws of physics break it down, because everything passes into the infinite. So I'm going to quote then a couple quotes I have here. First is from Rene Weber. This is 20 years ago, because what I realized is, like, Hawking's new book is like this new reason why we don't need God. But he was doing this whole thing 20 years ago, dealing with smearing out the Big Bang singularity. And this is how he was kind of like, his big thing was, you know, Hawking says we don't need God anymore if we can smear out the Big Bang singularity. And he's going to do that by developing a unified theory of quantum gravity. So now we don't need God anymore. Now we have Stephen Hawking. And that's what he was kind of arguing 20 years ago. And now in his newest book, he doesn't even mention what happened to that, like his previous argument for the non-existence of God. He doesn't even mention that. It's like it never happened. But here it is 20 years later, and I'm going to explain his newest ideas in M-theory, which he says now why we don't need God is because of this new development in M-theory. But what I saw is like the same... It's the same old thing. It's the same old hype, kind of. Like, he's got a new angle on why we don't need God. But anyway, it's interesting going back to what he was writing 20 years ago, because we see the same dynamics. This is, quote, Rene Weber says, Hawking hopes that there may not be a Big Bang, no edge to the universe that can be singled out and pointed to as the initial starting point, the singularity. His resistance derives from the fact that he believes an edge entails a God, at least a causal principle that functions like a definite starting point. And then this is what Hawking says. All our theories of science are formulated on the assumption that space-time is smooth and nearly flat, so they break down at the Big Bang singularity, where the curvature of space-time is infinite. Predictability would break down at the Big Bang. People do not like the idea that time has a beginning, probably because it smacks of divine intervention. There were, therefore, a number of attempts to avoid the conclusion that there had been a Big Bang. Okay, so he's saying we don't like this singularity because it smacks of divine intervention, which it certainly does, don't you think, Joe?
Well, Bernard Haich points out, you know, if you have something where the laws of physics break down, then what is it? You know, like if there's no laws of physics, then what causes the Big Bang? You know, I mean, so it has to be something.
It's interesting, like it's like Blavatsky's answer to that is what happens when the laws of physics break down? You have ancient metaphysics. You have metaphysics. Like that's what Blavatsky says. She says all physics carried far enough along lead to metaphysics.
Yeah, it's interesting too, because that's from Hawking, from Rene Weber. That's actually 1986, so it's like 25 years ago in the sense of probably what, by the time the book came out, it's probably more than 25 years ago. That's interesting how he's changed his tune, though. It's like,
yeah.
Well,
here's some other quotes, and just like these are his little philosophical musings in his book that he has.
Okay.
This is from A Brief History of Time. So long as the universe had a beginning, we could suppose it had a creator. But if a universe is really completely self-contained, having no boundary or edge, it would have neither beginning nor end. It would simply be. What place then for a creator? Now, it's hard to explain this, but partly what he's saying, like, see, Stephen Hawking is a quantum theorist. But the general theory of relativity, which predicts the singularity, it's not a quantum theory. Okay, they've never been able to formulate a quantum theory of gravity. So it is called classical theory because it doesn't incorporate the uncertainty principle and the quantum principle. So the general theory of relativity predicts a singularity, but quantum theory forbids it, because in quantum theory, when you try to analyze the nature of a particle, like the way Hawking views particles, elementary particles, he says that then when they pass from one point A to point B, they simultaneously explore all possible paths or trajectories between those points. And the fundamental reality is all these possible paths in imaginary time. Okay? And then out of all these possible paths in imaginary time, one of those is made manifest on any occasion. Okay? But the particle then, its real nature is this, what I would call plenum of all its possibilities. You see? So I'm trying to explain. So when Hawking traces the universe back to the singularity, he's not actually avoiding the singularity. You still have the singularity where the universe disappears down at Planckian levels at like 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. But then it's smeared out into this field of all possibilities in imaginary time. Okay, so he thinks that kind of solves it as a problem. Now this idea of the particle, of all possibilities of that particle in imaginary time, that's another way of viewing the nature of the plenum, which contains all possible states and of all possible particles and entities. So the plenum is like all these possible states of the particle in imaginary time. Well, that's because it's an eternal realm. You see, it is relative to our time. It is imaginary time. It's a different time dimension. It's a different time dimension, which is the eternal realm. Okay. See, in Blavatsky, you see, manifested universes manifest out of eternal principles, and at the end of time, they're absorbed back into the eternal principles. Okay, so, but the eternal principles exist eternally, so they're not only present at the beginning, at the end, but they underlie and sustain all manifestation. Okay, so, in a way, Hawking's, all his ideas about smearing out the Big Bang singularity into the, like, the Feynman sum of histories, that's what approach to particle physics, where you add up all the possible paths of a particle, that concept even is perfectly in accord, once again, with concepts in the mystical literature. But his interpretation of it is that, well, now we have this idea in physics, well, that explains the Big Bang singularity, and we don't need God anymore. Like, that's where he, like, his science carries him so far, and then all of a sudden he jumps to, oh, now we don't need God because we got this explanation, kind of. I've talked on quite a bit, Jim, so maybe I'll get any reactions to any of what I'm saying.
I haven't understood anything you've said for the last 15 minutes, but that's fine. No, it's very complex, but as you say, well, I think what you're pointing out is how he's changed his argument, I think, shows that he keeps searching for within theoretical physical explanations for a way to do away with God, but that's, I guess, the fact that he keeps sort of grasping at these different straws shows how desperate he is, and again, as I say, it's really got nothing to do, what he's talking about has nothing to do with spiritual realities or the existence of God. I don't get how he can extrapolate from these things and draw these conclusions. It's odd, too, very interesting that to contrast his work with that of a physicist like Bernard Haisch or somebody like David Bohm, who deal with these big questions and arrive at radically different conclusions. And so there you see... There you see right there that there's really nothing, as you say, it's his opinions. There's nothing inherently in these theories or in their verification through experiments. There's nothing inherently in those theories which denies spiritual realities or leads to those conclusions. He's imposing his own beliefs and really looking for things to validate his own assumptions and his own denial of these realities. So,
what's the problem in there is though he doesn't state that, even though, well, in a way, he even remains mute about, well, does he really believe that? Yeah, I mean, he doesn't directly state he doesn't believe in God. What they say about the book is just that science offers a possible model of the creation of the universe, which doesn't require a creator. And I agree it does that. Like, I don't think it's necessarily the case that there has to be a creator. I don't agree with that position either. I mean, I believe there is. I believe there's a hierarchy of creative intelligences, but I agree. Like science traces the universe back to a singularity, and they have models of everything that happened from that first moment of creation, you know, and all the physics that go on in the early universe, and then, you know, different eras as you have the formation of supergalactic clusters, and then galaxies and suns and supernova creating other particles, and down to evolution. Like, they have a model of the whole creation all the way up to humankind evolving. Like, they have a model of all that. So that is a feasible model. It doesn't follow automatically that there is a creator. That's all I'm saying. You know, that's a moot point. There could be or there couldn't be. That's a moot point that we have to try to think critically about and try to explore.
Yeah. I don't think physics can answer this question. But I think that there are things in physics which can lead to a more coherent worldview, which will either support or deny the existence of a creator. It's funny. The other day, my nephew said to me something to the effect in an email exchange. He was reacting to that piece that I wrote on Hawking, and he said, you know, in the end, you know, I don't really care, and I prefer to kind of make fun of both points of view, but, you know, it's not, I guess for me, like, that question isn't really in and of itself. It's an interesting intellectual question that has all sorts of implications for things, but it really takes on its meaning in terms of what kind of how it sort of prescribes what kind of world we live in. I believe that we do live in a world where there's spirit and where there's spiritual intelligences, but that's more related to my own life and trying to derive some sense of significance from it. Like you get somebody like Weinberg who says that, you know, that you more that you study things, the more you see that human beings are just an accidental creation and everything's absurd and there's no meaning to it and everything. And that very kind of nihilistic materialist position. And I just, you know, I don't agree with that. I think that the evidence is overwhelming that that's wrong. But I would draw the evidence for the primary evidence I draw to come to a very different conclusion is from the mystical and esoteric teachings and the experiences of mystical and esoteric masters and people who have had these experiences of higher spiritual realities. I believe that that's important evidence. And that's why that leads back to why really the physics can provide us with something, but it's not a comprehensive perspective. I mean, the whole idea that I think the so-called theories of everything, I think that's a gross misnomer because they're not theories of everything. They're theories which are trying to unify fundamental physical forces, but they're not theories of everything.
They assume that the that if they can explain the elementary forces of physics in the unified theory, then it automatically follows the laws of chemistry, biology, medicine.
Everything's derivative from that.
Planetary arrangements and so on. Everything is a derivative of that. And they don't, so that's a huge, as you say. And then they also don't understand how the enigmas of consciousness.
Yeah.
Because even our knowledge of the world is so dependent upon our own faculties.
And that's just not recognized in modern sciences that really, you know, it's just in the last 150 or 200 years or so that we've had really the collapse of the great chain of being that Ken Wilber calls it the tragedy of modernity is that we're really the, you know, in the history of humankind, people have always believed in this hierarchy of world orders and of different levels of consciousness and intelligence. And really, that's a modern construction is to say that no, it's just to collapse everything is one level of consciousness. But that's clearly not right. That's what's been thrown out and what's not recognized, which leads to this whole perspective of people who are well-educated, intelligent, who are scientists and other types of specialists. They don't recognize that there are people who have achieved higher levels of consciousness and being and that have made themselves, have made these things permanent within themselves and have taught a very different presented a very different teaching about the nature of the universe and of ourselves, and that's the piece that's missing that these guys just don't recognize whatsoever, which, you know, leads to all sorts of different implications about what's the nature of our being, what's the nature of the universe, what's the nature of reality. So the thing is, getting back to what I was saying before about, like, you know, this question about the nature of creation is a big question. I don't think I'm really ever going to get the answer in my lifetime, but it's not an important question on one level, but it's a hugely important question on another level. It all boils down to what it says about the nature of reality and whether or not there is a spiritual reality, which I believe there is, and I think the evidence is, as I say, exists in places other than in modern physics, because modern physics doesn't deal with that. So, you know. But on the, again, coming back to your point, what's so interesting, what's so intriguing, is that really you can make the argument that modern physics is confirming what mystics and esotericists have taught for thousands and thousands of years. That's fascinating.
Yeah, and that's my main argument. Like that.
Yeah, it's a very,
because
very interesting
argument.
Because
I'm saying even Hawking's solution, like to the Big Bang singularity, how he kind of smears out the singularity into the whole field of the all possible states of that particle.
Yeah.
Okay. In a way, and how I say these concepts are exactly what we find in the secret doctrine. Like in the Vedas, it is said, there's a saying, simultaneously one and different. So it's like every little finite thing is ultimately an expression of the infinite. So what that means in a way is you follow any finite thing far enough, at some point, when it merges with the infinite, it's going to disappear from view on a lower level of reality as it disappears into the infinite. And that's all that Stephen Hawking is doing. He's dissolving this singularity back into the infinite in imaginary time.
Yeah.
Well, how about God in the eternal?
Yeah, well, it's funny because I was reading Ramana Maharshi last night, and he keeps telling people, you know, it's like they don't have that, they have the wrong conceptualization of the nature of self and a lie, and but he keeps saying, like, you know, well, everything really is in self, and
yeah.
Including there is no person to be realized, because really, once you realize, you're in self, so there, everything collapses, everything's smeared out into self, eh? And so, self is the eternal, so you know, it's that's really fascinating in a way, because I mean, again, that's a mystical and esoteric teaching, which is really sounds suspiciously like what Hawking is proposing about physics. You know, it's like,
yeah.
You know, yeah, there is a, yeah, on a certain level, he's right. You know, that yeah, everything could be smeared out, but what does
yeah,
that
but-
mean? What's the,
yeah,
what's the
it's
mean?
Still confirming the ancient mystical teachings, you know,
yeah.
That everything, when it returns into its Laya state, it disappears from view, absorbed back into the eternal realm,
yeah.
You know, and that's a different way of expressing what he says,
yeah.
You know, it's absorbed back into the sum of all its possibilities in imaginary time, you know, it's just this different language a bit.
But I
want to try to move on. I was going to say move on a little bit, because I want to try to see what I was trying to, what I realized is that, oh yeah, 20 to 30 years ago, Hawking back then was trying to sell his books by, you know, getting rid of the Big Bang singularity to get rid of God. But now he's got a new angle on it. So I just wanted to put this book in the historic context a bit.
Okay.
You know, because that's what I see now. All of a sudden, no, it's the same wolf in sheep's clothes. whatever. It's the same idea, but it's got a new kind of logic and format to it a bit, which is interesting. Okay, so early on in the book, he says, one sec. We will describe how M theory may offer answers to the question of creation. According to M theory, ours is not the only universe. Instead, M theory predicts that a great many universes were created out of nothingness, out of nothing. Their creation does not require the intervention of some supernatural being or God. Rather, these multiple universes arise naturally from physical law. Okay, now what is M theory? So, it's hard to explain this, but as physicists have tried to unify the different laws of nature, what they have to do is they have to deal with higher energetic levels, and they, in order to unify different laws of physics, you have to postulate these different gauge symmetries in higher dimensional spaces, and you have to have these other fields which are latent within the quantum vacuum. So when scientists began to add up how many extra dimensions they needed, they arrived at the number 7. Okay, so the newest M theory that Stephen Hawking says is the ultimate theory is what's called, it's 11 dimensional. Okay, so it postulates there are 4 large dimensions of space and time, and then at every point underneath or underlying the four large space-time dimensions, there are seven interior dimensions curled up in this little interior space. Okay, Jim, you're familiar with this from my work, the Calabi-Yau spaces, eh? That I had in one model of physics. See, first they thought these particles and quanta were like little strings. But then they, as string theory advanced, then they thought there weren't just strings, but there were also membranes and then other more complex shapes. And some of the shapes that scientists think are down at these Planckian levels, we're talking down at 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. I lost myself a little bit, Jim.
What the shape of them was? You were saying that they used to think that they were strings, but now that...
Then they began to think they were membranes. And then they came to this idea of these little Calabi-Yau spaces. And it's like, what it's like is as if there's one of these Calabi-Yau seven-dimensional hyperspace, Calabi-Yau space, that exists at every point underlying familiar four-dimensional space-time. Okay, so this is what M theory involves, is this concept that we live in this 11-dimensional universe with seven hidden dimensions underlying the familiar four-dimensional space-time. Okay, now, once again, if I go back to the secret doctrine, the first stanza of Zen, this ancient mystical creation poetry, it says... Oh, what does it say? The first verse. The eternal parent had slumbered again for seven eternities. And Blavatsky explains the eternal parent wrapped in her ever-invisible robes had slumbered once again for seven eternities. So the eternal parent for Blavatsky is what she calls the seven-skinned eternal parent space. And essentially Blavatsky's concept of this is, in modern terminology, we would call it a seven-dimensional hyperspace. Okay, so the first stanza of the Book of Zen is referring to there being a seven-dimensional hyperspace underlying the familiar world. Hello? Are you there, Jim?
Yep.
Oh, did you get a buzz and strange sound? Or?
No.
Oh, I had it again.
Oh.
Okay. Maybe someone was calling in on me and I'm getting a ring on my line. So Stephen Hawking is endorsing this M theory, which postulates this seven-dimensional hyperspace underlying our familiar space-time. Okay, so again, his candidate for this ultimate theory postulates a seven-dimensional hyperspace, which is exactly one of the main teachings of the secret doctrine back in 1888. Blavatsky called it the eternal parent space. And Blavatsky explained that she said everything in the metaphysical as well as the physical is septenary or sevenfold. That this is a basic principle of creation. And we find it in Kabbalah. In Kabbalah, in the Tree of Life, you have three supernals, and those three supernals give birth or give rise to the seven lower sephira. Okay, so the seven are born out of the three. Hello? Do we have a guest there or someone in the background? Okay. Jim, are you still there?
Yeah. Oh, sorry. That was my speaker. Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay, I'm getting different kinds of interference and things a bit, but I'll try to keep on and not let it distract me.
I'm getting it now, too.
Okay, so anyway, so here we have Hawking. First, the new theory he's endorsing is this model, as you've heard me speak of before, Jim, of 11-dimensional. There's different words for it. Sometimes it's called 11-dimensional KK supergravity theory. That was one terminology. Now it's called M theory, and it has to do with these kind of Calabi-Yau spaces curled up in these interior spaces. So anyway, but the whole point of this model of physics is in a remarkable way analogous to what Blavatsky describes in The Secret Doctrine. Both there being a seven-dimensional hyperspace, but in modern physics, physicists are trying to understand all the little interior holes in these Calabi-Yau spaces. Because, see, these are complex little, like, pixels on a screen, where every point in space is one of these little pixels. And each little pixel has a whole seven higher dimensional nature. And it has all these little holes that curl through these interior dimensions in these higher space. Now, what is so remarkable is that in The Secret Doctrine of Blavatsky, she says that the universe is founded on seven invisible holes, seven holes dug in space. So Blavatsky has this concept of these little holes down at 0-point levels in higher dimensional space, and that these are the mechanisms for the laws of nature are produced through these holes dug in space. Okay, so this whole concept of M theory that Hawking is endorsing is all so consistent with what Blavatsky is explaining in The Secret Doctrine. But anyway, so now in this M theory, there's all different possibilities. It's like a mathematical playground that physicists have trying to calculate all the possibilities of these little holes dug in these higher dimensional spaces. And if these holes were in different patterns, how the universe could have had very different laws of nature. Okay, because there's so many different possibilities. And Hawking says that in M theory, the number of possibilities are 10 to the power of 500, which is like an unbelievably huge, unbelievable number, like billions and trillions and millions and billions of trillions, like this endless number, a huge, huge number. So he says all these are possible mathematics of these little the holes in these higher dimensional elements. Okay, and okay, so now what I'm trying to come to is explaining his logic in here. So what he comes up with is this M theory. You see, in M theory, you have all these possibilities of all different possible worlds where the laws of nature, he says, if you had a different internal membrane structure, you could have a whole different world produced with different laws of nature. So in another world, maybe an electron is twice as big, or the force of gravity is a quarter as large. So out of these, the nothingness, what he's saying is you can have all these different worlds produced, each of which can have different laws of nature. But some of them, the laws of nature in that world, will be such that it won't last at all. It'll just be dissolved right away. Or it can be creating a multiverse all out of the same underlying principle. Okay, and it could create 10 to the power of 500 different universes out of this. Now, all of this ties back for Hawking into science. In the discussions of God and science, there's always been debate about the fine-tuning of the universe. Like, they used to deal with examples concerning our environment. For instance, if the Earth were so much closer to the sun, all the water would boil up and we couldn't have had organic life on Earth. Whereas if it had been too far away, it would have been too cold on the Earth and we wouldn't have had life. So a planet has to be in a certain range of distance from the sun. Okay, and then we have the tilt of the Earth, which has various effects and gives us the seasons and the elliptical orbit. So it gives us the season that modulates our environment. Okay, and that's done just in the right way. And if it had been just this way or that way, it wouldn't have worked out. So there's all these, you know, if there had been more irregularities in the first expansion of the universe, or if there hadn't been more irregularities, we wouldn't have had galaxies. Or if there's all these what they call lucky coincidences, kind of that we were had just happened to be on the planet the right where we had the right combination of atmosphere and the sun and the warmth and so on. Okay, so that's a fine tuning in terms of respect to organic life on Earth. So some people would argue, well, then it has to be by design, okay, because everything is just perfectly balanced. And Hawking explains, well, that used to be an argument, but now we realize that there are so many billions and billions of different solar systems, and we're finding more and more which have different planets. So, you know, you're bound to find some, you know, there's bound to be millions and billions of solar systems where you'll have a similar range of values that could give birth to organic life on Earth. So, you know, it's called the weak anthropic principle, that because, you know, we happen to live on a planet where the conditions were just right. But, I mean, there were many other places where the conditions weren't right, and so they didn't give rise to beings who could ask about, you know, where they came from. So in a way, you can, you know, we just happen to be on this planet. We don't need God to have designed it. Instead, we can just explain it by understanding there are billions of galaxies and billions of solar systems and billions of planets, and there just happened, life happened to arise in some solar systems. Okay, so now that was one level of the people used to argue about the fine tuning of the solar system for life to arise on planet Earth. But the Hawking's pointing out now there's a whole new level of fine tuning that scientists have arrived at. And these concern the laws of nature and the fundamental constants of nature. Like if the size of an electron had been like 2% bigger, then this and that would have happened and it would have been impossible to form molecules. And, you know, if gravity had been a bit stronger or the Planck's constant smaller or whatever, it's like if any of these fundamental constants of nature were a little bit different, the whole thing wouldn't have worked and life wouldn't have arisen. So then again, the theistic person would say, well, that shows God designed it, so it was just designed right. Whereas what Hawking is now saying, no, because of M theory, you see, M theory can give rise to 10 to the power of 500 possible universes, billions and billions and trillions of universes. So what happened was it just happened to be the right conditions in our universe. You see, he's extending the same line of argument, you know, about how, you know, the fine-tuning of the solar system. Now we're talking about the fine-tuning of the laws of physics. They just happen to be right to give rise to life. But we don't need to explain that in terms of their being due to a creator. What we have instead is this new model of M-theory, which postulates 10 to the power of 500 possible universes. So we've got a big enough sample that we happen to be in one of those universes where it happened to all work out right. So now we have an explanation of this, and now we don't need God. And that's it, Jim. A little hop, a skip, and a jump at the end. That's what they do.
I guess that the one thing I wonder about was, whatever happened to Oakham and his razor? You know, because that's always an explanation. That's always a something that the materialists invoke when they want to defend a materialist position as well. That, you know, the Occam's razor is that the, you know, don't make any unnecessary assumptions about things. Don't extend things to be more complex than is necessary in terms of explaining things. And so they're always saying, you know, simple is better. And yet, when it comes to the anthropic principle, all of a sudden, oh well, you know, there was just so many universes created that one of them was bound to wind up this way. Really, I mean, that actually may be true, and in a way, I think that probably is true. But I think the idea of infinite worlds is clearly a possible reality. But as an explanation, it's pretty lame, and it's very ad hoc. I mean, it's sort of smacks of clutching at straws to preserve a point of view. But that's the way I see it, anyway.
Yeah, I mean, it is. It seems that it's a traditional technique of the promissory scientist.
Yeah,
is
materialism.
Yeah, I'm kind of losing a little bit what I'm trying to say here.
The more enigmas and mysteries that confront them, the more that they want to draw on something to make it all go away. Say, well, there really isn't any great mystery, and just if we adhere to our current tack, you know, we'll eventually figure it all out.
Yeah, I remember what it was arriving at now. It's like the arguments over evolution. And it's like in modern science, evolution was supposed to have happened, according to all the prominent scientists for the last 50 years, according to random genetic changes caused by kind of happenstance, like different genetic or radiations and so on. So there's this kind of pool of random genetic changes, and some are adaptive and the others maladaptive, and some survive and others not, and they propagate more and so on. And so it's always by happenstance, and it just happened. And
yeah,
and always, but in evolution, like when you just have random genetic changes in any organism, like it doesn't just produce, you know, more evolved forms of that organism. Like, you know, generally, like, random genetic changes are all destructive. And all the systems of a human body, it's not like you can change one gene and then it affects all other kinds of systems. Like, it's fanciful, this idea they had of just enough random genetic changes. And then they needed hundreds and millions of years to allow all these kind of random genetic changes. But you look in the fossil record, you don't see a history of all these different kinds of human beings from different periods. I mean, a little bit different forms, but not as you would expect if you had this kind of all these random genetic changes. I mean, you would have needed a huge pool of human beings for this to work in the first place, you know? It's like, oh, there's so many possibilities, and you give it enough time, and eventually that tornado will blow through a junk pile and assemble a jet for you.
Yeah.
That's how one biologist compared
I think it was actually Fred Hoyle, actually, the cosmologist, who suggested that it is about as likely
as a tornado.
Yeah, going through a junkyard. And there are various arguments against the so-called naturalistic explanations put forward by evolution. That, I mean, I think that there's obviously some things that evolution describes properly, but I think the complexity of things is much greater than is recognized. Well, again, I'll go back to the point that I keep bringing up, but it's just like the continuous nature of the physical organism, human beings, everything's turning over all the time in terms of your cells are being replaced and you're not the same person you were 2 years ago. And there has to be some sort of guiding intelligence or some sort of field of intelligence which is informing the physical manifestations, which accounts for our physical presence. It's so much more complex than I think that is generally recognized. And I think the big questions, I mean, the nature of how life arises, I think is like the nature of how consciousness arises, I think is really inexplicable in terms of a materialist perspective. There's got to be something more there, and I think that something more is given in the mystical and esoteric explanations, is that we live in a universe of varying levels of consciousness and intelligence, and that they're stepped down and manifest on the material plane and in the physical realm, and that, you know, you have to look beyond that to get the more comprehensive explanation of things. And I think many physicists are, you know, in contrast to Hawking, as I say, Eddington's whole perspective on it was that okay, physics can bring us to a certain understanding of things, but beyond that, there is something. There's clearly something beyond that, and physics can't get to it. So, and then he suggested that perhaps mysticism was the way to. Was the way to understand these things, and as I say, it's the same with evolution in terms of, you know, all the things that biologists study in terms of evolutionary processes. I think they account for some things, but I think there are such huge gaps in that explanation. It's like you don't have to be a creationist to deny the comprehensiveness of evolutionary theory. I'm not really sure that natural selection really does explain things. The more I read about it, the more doubtful I become about even, you know, how applicable that explanation is. And as I say, that doesn't make you a fundamentalist creationist. I think that you have to look at everything critically and with an open mind. I just say that the mysteries and the enigmas are so huge there that I just can't accept that that's a comprehensive or thorough explanation of things at all. As you say, too, in terms of human beings, that there should be all sorts of different types of human beings. It's like even the idea like that genes, you know, there's a very good discussions of this. Richard Lawton, an American biologist, discusses this extensively in his writings about this overemphasis on how genes are supposedly accounting for everything. And as he points out, that's just not, you know, that's just not right. It's not right biologically. And that's something that you won't see in Dawkins' work. Dawkins makes all sorts of preposterous claims about biology, which I, you know, there are many dissenting viewpoints on that from highly acclaimed biologists. I mean, he just goes completely overboard in terms of what he claims biology has established and what the implications are for the existence of God and spiritual realities and everything else that he doesn't want to recognize as existing.
Okay, I'm going to just try to come back a little bit to, so we have all those enigmas in the life sciences. Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think that all the biological life, there's something in organisms in terms of underlying fields and metaphysics to living being that we have to have that kind of understanding that there are these underlying fields. And it's just like sprinkle iron filings on a page of paper over a magnet, and they kind of take a particular form. Well, the idea is that there's underlying force fields underlying the body, and that those inform the physical body. But just to come back a bit, so I want to give this. So a couple things. First, so that is what I realized is like the main thrust of the book, The Grand Design, is that Hawking is arrived at this M theory. And what's so, it's an amazingly aggravating book, because I wanted to hear, well, what is this new ideas in M theory? What does it entail? And how, what happened to his quantum gravity theory that he always used to talk about? Doesn't talk about that in here at all. It's like that other world didn't exist. And this is his new kick, kind of, you know? Is this M theory with all these possible universes, and this can explain the fine tuning. And it's, again, it's like science that believes in kind of random fortuitous events, but they've got a possible model of it in science. And okay, so, but then they take it as proven, and they don't, the theory's not even complete, and then there's the interpretation of the theory, because really the theory is quite consistent with something like the secret doctrine. But anyway, here at one point is some of Hawking's philosophizing, which I think some people support a model in which time goes back even further than the Big Bang. It is not yet clear whether a model in which time continued back beyond the Big Bang would be better at explaining present observations, because it seems the laws of the evolution of the universe may break down at the Big Bang. If they do, it would make no sense to create a model which encompasses time before the Big Bang, because what existed then would have no observable consequences for the present. And so we might as well stick with the idea that the Big Bang was the creation of the world. Now, what he's saying here is, like, it's totally preposterous from the perspective of the secret doctrine of Blavatsky, because he's saying, like, we can trace this back to the Big Bang, but we can't ask what came before the Big Bang. Okay, well, the secret doctrine of Blavatsky is an explanation of what she says was before the Big Bang. That's the whole point of the book, because it begins when everything is absorbed in non-being, and you have an eternal parent space, which is seven-dimensional hyperspace, and you have seven luminous lords who are absorbed in the web of non-being. And when creation happens, those seven luminous lords emerge. And so Blavatsky describes the root principles underlying creation, which exist before creation occurs. And that seems perfectly sensible. Like, why would Hawking say we can only go back to the Big Bang and we can't ask about what was before that? Well, I mean, it absolutely makes no sense. I mean, Blavatsky is saying about these other principles that they are eternal, so they are outside of time as we would judge time, okay? And creation emerges out of the eternal principles, and it's absorbed back into them at the end of time, but even the whole while during its existence, it's always rooted into the eternal, because the eternal realm, this seven-dimensional hyperspace, underlies and sustains and interconnects all things. Okay, now Hawking is saying, he's saying, no, we can't go back to ask what was before the Big Bang, because it would have no observable consequences for the present. Now, consider that compared to what Blavatsky says. She says that these seven luminous lords are latent within non-being, within the seven-skinned eternal parent space, before creation happens. And then when creation happens, these seven luminous lords emerge, and and she then, the stanzas describe, they state, seven inside, seven outside. So the idea, you have the seven luminous lords absorbed in non-being at the beginning, but when creation happens, these divine beings emanate out of non-being, and they create a seven-dimensional spiritual world above. And then they create a seven-dimensional material world below. Okay, so so in Blavatsky, see, seven inside, seven outside. So from Blavatsky's perspective, if we want to understand the nature of the root principles of creation, what we want to do is study what is made manifest. You see? We don't, like, what Hawking is saying is ridiculous. That what he's saying, the nature of the absolute has no consequence for what we observe about us. But what we really would want to do is try to understand the nature of the absolute, given what we see in phenomena about us. Jim, are you seeing, is my point coming across? Does that seem obvious to you as well?
Yeah, well, of course, yeah. It's like, I don't know, as you say, aggravating is the term that sort of comes to mind about Hawking and all of these guys. Is like, you know, that's very interesting. I like, yeah.
It's a very peculiar attitude, and I like the way at the bottom of it. Like, here's this big scientist, and here's their sentence. And so we might as well stick with the idea that the Big Bang was a creation. Okay, like, is that how science advances, when scientists decides, we may as well stick with this idea?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, even if you disagreed with the other idea, you'd still want to think it out,
well,
wouldn't you?
Yeah, sort of.
I think we'll stick with this idea. Like, that's what they're like, because they kind of saying science proves this. And the elements of science they bring out are valuable ideas, and I have no problem with those. But then it's that leap of faith on their part, like,
yeah,
their interpretation of that and what they think it proves, and how it disproves a mystical idea. And they're completely illiterate when it comes to what metaphysics involves anyway.
Yeah, well, that's the whole other side of it, is that they, you know, I think most people would be quite astounded. They would assume that a guy that this bright, you know, would know about these things, and when he says he disapproves of mysticism, that's an informed opinion. But what's so clear when you read these guys and their pejorative comments about mysticism is that they have absolutely no clue. They're complete ignoramuses when it comes to the topic. They don't know anything.
Yeah.
And
yeah, they don't.
Their statements about mysticism and esotericism and their denial of meaning, even though they don't know what these teachings say, is really a profession of faith on their part. I mean, it's a belief in things unseen, in an odd sense, you know, like it's faith in science, like it's faith in materialism. I mean, and that's the other thing, is that they equate materialism with science, and I mean that there's nothing inherent in science that means that you know, scientific knowledge has to be materialistic. That's just a theory. That's just a paradigm, and it's one that's reached its limits of its explanatory power. But they're so dogmatic about it, and so hidebound, like you say, that they come up with ridiculous comments like, "Well, we'll just leave it at that." You know, like, why? What are you so afraid of?
Yeah.
You might have to change your ideas. That's what they're afraid of.
So like, yeah.
Wrong.
So
you might be
so
really
anyway.
Wrong.
It was very interesting reading the book,
yeah,
because the whole thing brings back, like, he poses the problem of a God's contracting universe. If we hadn't posed it 30 years ago based on Carl Sagan's writing, he would be like the exact same exact type example today. Like, he's like the Hollywood scientist today, in a way, like Sagan was in his day. Kind of like Mr. Science, kind of, you know? And
well, it's interesting, too, because Steven Weinberg essentially, he wrote an article in the New York Review of Books a couple of years ago, and basically said it was almost exactly what Sagan had said 35 years ago.
Oh, yeah. And
made exactly the same arguments, you know, about the God of the gaps. And it's a recurrent... It's a recurrent theme, and it's approached from different angles. And I mean, Dawkins goes one better, and basically says, "Well, not only is is God's universe contracting? It's like it's all over for God, according to Hawking. You know, he has a chapter in his book in the God Delusion. Why there almost certainly is no God."
Yeah, I'd be interested to read
which
that.
Which is based on. You know,
yeah.
I don't know what. Biology.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know,
I have a subheading in The Problem of God's Contracting Universe entitled, Why sorry. Richard Dawkins is almost certainly not as smart as he thinks he is. In reply to that.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's like they have a whole agenda that certain groups of physicists and biologists and philosophers and are trying to undermine kind of religious belief or belief in metaphysical or occult things. That kind of undermine that.
Which
is fine to have as a perspective, but it's not to present it as though that represents the results of science. You know, that because the findings of science are so unusual and spectacular in this day that the interpretation of those, I mean, firstly, they confirm many ancient mystical ideas, and then within science itself, it's like they're so bizarre. These science, like, he doesn't really explain at all, well, what this M theory is, eh? In this whole book, he's got like about 4 pages on M theory, but it's kind of like talking around it or about it, but not really explaining it in any way. You know, it's a frustrating book because he goes through, you know, 2,000 years of all these kind of philosophers and so on and so forth, and then kind of like hardly says anything about the newest ideas in physics. As he's not even on the forefront of physics. He mentions a holographic principle in one line, and he says, "Oh, by the way, there's another theory that you know," and he has one line. I forget what he says in that one line, but he doesn't deal with that concept, and it's a profound new view beyond M theory, in a way. In this new holographic physics, the model that I outline in my book, like you have these like little 7-dimensional black hole microprocessors established in higher dimensional space, and their spin activity creates different substances surrounding them on different shells, in a holographic shell surrounding the central point, and how the physics of black holes applies in this higher dimensional space, and that's rendered equivalent to quantum theory physics on the shells. So there's this whole model of kind of higher dimensions underlying the material reality, and that's all just new and emerging. And like he mentions none of that. He mentions nothing of his black holes expertise. Like he's supposed to be one of the leading black hole physicists in the world. He doesn't even mention black holes in the book. The whole thing is most peculiar. So it's a disappointing book. It's just there's an agenda here, kind of, and you know, I honor and respect the person individually, and it's an interesting book, but it's also frustrating, and I see the Hollywood nature of it all. Jim, are you there? Okay, well, I'm not sure if I've lost Jim or if I'm on air. Okay, so we lost Jim for a moment. We're trying to reconnect here. I'm going to post my review of The Grand Design on my website, hopefully this week. And this week, my own book, which I think it's amazing. It's come out at the same time as Hawking's book. My book's called God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine. And it deals with all the areas that Hawking goes into in his book. And it goes into these new ideas in physics and explains how most of these ideas were there in the secret doctrine and how really science is arriving at a point where it's confirming the ancient mystical ideas about creation metaphysics. See, as Blavatsky says, all physics carried far enough must lead to ancient metaphysics because these metaphysics exist. And I think the development of modern physics, especially the newer ideas about higher dimensions and these black hole mini processors in higher dimensional space, and how the activities of those could create matter surrounding a central point. The idea is that all living beings have a zero-point center. And I actually argue this for human beings, too, that we have a zero-point center. See, in a way, the issues of the creation of the universe are very important, because the ideas and arguments apply not only to the creation of the universe, but also to ourselves in the inner dimensions of our being. Because I think the creation of a human life, the way we ourselves come out of nothingness in the same way as does the universe. We ourselves have a singularity zero-point center, the same way does the universe. We ourselves are rooted into seven-dimensional hyperspace. I believe that each human being has a divine spark or a monadic essence, and this little element is established in higher dimensional space. And it has spin properties, and there's a web of spirit and matter spun around this central point, and that point is then clothed in different bodies. And so we come down out of higher dimensions into different subtle and material bodies. So I believe there's this whole higher dimensional physics to human consciousness and to the human heart. And so... today I've been talking about Stephen Hawking. I lost my co-host. I'll wrap. Oh, is that you, Jim?
Yep.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, you're back. I was just kind of wrapping up. We have a minute here.
Yeah, we had a power surge and it knocked my phone and computer out and turned my television on. Very peculiar, but I just wanted to say in conclusion, I don't know if you've mentioned your website at all.
No, I hadn't. Yeah, I'll let you.
Oh, okay. It's www.zeropoint.ca. And I guess you're going to post your a review of Hawking's book on there. I'll look forward to that. That'll be interesting.
Yeah, and I'll be redoing the first page, because once I know that my book is available, God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine, I'm gonna kind of put it up there at the top, and I hope to promote this book. It's perfect timing, given that this Stephen Hawking book has come out, because I present such an alternative kind of viewpoint with so much of the same material. Like so many things he discusses are things I go into too, you know, expanding, contracting space times, the quantum vacuum, you know, yeah, so I hope you'll get the book, Jim. I'm sure there'll be lots of fodder there for the discussion. And
yeah, I'm looking forward to it, actually. I'm going to go out and buy it now, and I'm looking forward to reading it.
Yeah, and I'm still working on it. I'm going to reread it so I really comprehend it well. Okay, well, we'll be back in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Thank you, BBS Radio. It's a pleasure to have this kind of forum to try to present this more complex kind of material. Thank you all.
And thanks, Seth, for getting me back on the air. And, thanks, Chris. It was good.
Okay, thanks, Jim.
Okay,
goodbye.
Bye.